Welcome, everyone, to today's Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online session moderator. In just a few moments, we'll turn things over to your first instructor, Michelle Mahoney, who's joining you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. Following Michelle, we'll take Fran Costanzi from EPA Region 8, and then we'll close out today's broadcast with a presentation by Tom Bloom from EPA Region 5. Today's topic is part of the NARPM Presents series, where we'll be exploring recreational and educational opportunities at Superfund sites. Before we begin the technical portion of today's broadcast, I'm going to kick off with just a couple of reminder items for those of you who are joining the webinar. Again, if you're unsure how to begin or what to do, I'll refer you back to a reminder email that you should have received for today's broadcast, which has a complete set of instructions on joining us. That email will point you to something known as the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you can read more about the broadcast. You'll find links to download presentation materials. When we have multiple slide decks and files, we oftentimes will put them over on the links or resources page to the left. There's also contact information and bios for your instructors for today's session. For now, though, you'll want to click a button labeled Go to Seminar, which appears in the upper left corner of that page. Once you click that button, you will be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location. Again, it looks like we've got about 24 or so people who have joined us, and that number continues to creep up. So welcome to those of you who have already signed in. Our entire broadcast today will be offered online using Adobe Connect, which will permit our presenters to give their talks from various locations across the country in real time using the web. And that means they're going to control movement through the PowerPoint presentations. You'll be able to listen and watch in real time right through Adobe Connect. If you have any technical difficulties or are unable to check in online, you can simply download the slides and listen in on the conference line. Just know there may be some interactive portions that you miss out on. As I mentioned, audio will be available online for all participants. That means by default, you should be able to hear me right through your computer speakers or with a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, please check your local volume settings first. Some people need to wear headphones or boost their sound control panel output to a higher level in order to get it loud enough. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply use the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, where you'll see a welcome message from me. You can type in your question or request a call-in number there at any time. Just know if you join us on the phones, you will be placed on a global mute, and I ask that you remain on that global mute to minimize background noises and other audio disruptions. Participants are welcome to submit questions and comments for our instructors at any time using the Q&A window in the lower right. To submit a comment or question, simply click on the box at the bottom of the Q&A window. You should be able to type up your message and either hit enter or press that cartoon-looking bubble button on the right. And again, that'll privately submit your message in. You can ask as many comments and as many questions as you like. You can also use that same box to report technical problems. We will take a designated break after each presenter to go through questions geared towards their talk. And with whatever time we have left over, we'll try to go back through any outstanding questions we may still have in the queue. Today's session is being recorded, and we will automatically share the recording via an email. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to prepare that final recording, and you're certainly welcome to share that with others that will find it a valuable expenditure of their time. If you can't wait, you can certainly take a look at the nearly 600 previously recorded seminars that we currently have available on our archives page. Again, just a brief reminder, you will see a copy of the presentation materials here on the left side of your screen. Each participant can make the slides bigger if they like. In the upper right, there should be a button that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that four-arrowed button once, it'll make the slides bigger. Click it a second time, they'll shrink back down. You can feel free to go in and out of that expanded view as needed. You'll see information about our sponsorship in the upper right. There's a collection of related URLs in the middle right. You can click on any one of those and press the Browse To button to open them up locally. Again, the seminar materials are posted on the seminar resources page. If you're watching the recorded version, those links are still available and clickable through the recorded archive. And then, of course, the interactive Q&A window here in the lower right. You can type up your comments and questions here, hit enter, or press that cartoon bubble button to the right to submit them. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to go ahead and switch gears and pull up presentations from our first presenter. Again, our first presenter is going to be joining you here from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, Michelle Mahoney. Michelle works on contaminated site remediation and reuse within the EPA's Superfund program, where she provides support to practitioners on the use of soil amendments for remediation, redevelopment, reuse, ecological revitalization, and terrestrial carbon sequestration, as well as urban gardening. Michelle, whenever you're ready, please feel free to begin.
Great. Thank you so much, Jean, for the introduction and for orienting everyone into our webinar today. Like Jean said, my division supports the Superfund program, but we also support other EPA programs, including the solid waste program, emergency management, underground storage tanks, and the brownfields program. We also partner with other federal and international agencies, other countries, state, tribal, local, and private organizations to improve site remediation practices. But as Jean mentioned, I deal specifically with providing tools to support our remedial project managers and on-scene coordinators related to ecological revitalization of contaminated properties. And ecological revitalization, basically you're returning a land from its contaminated site state to one that supports a functioning and sustainable habitat. And to date, we have more than 100 Superfund sites that are in planned or actual ecological reuse, and I'll show you some websites where you can search databases with that information. So much of the technical assistance that is provided through my division, which is the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, as you see the acronym here, TIFSD. We focus on the site remedial components, but the agency as a whole has a priority to consider reuse throughout the cleanup process, and that means that we're taking the technical aspects of how a remedy is designed and how is that going to play a key part in the future site reuse, and you're going to see a lot of examples of how we do that in today's presentation. Another great place or resource where you can find a lot of the information we have on ecological revitalization is at this webpage you see on this slide. We call it EcoTools, Tools for Ecological Land Reuse. There's three major ways that my office has and can provide technical assistance for ecological revitalization and reuse of sites. We do information exchange in what we are calling eco-forums. We do reuse planning and an educational eco-curriculum we've created. These tools support, and the tools and the support are accomplished through interagency agreements that we have at the regional level and directly with site stakeholders. Our interagency agreements allow us to bring experts in, people with many, many years of experience on doing these types of remedies, and they can, share with our site managers their experience and advice on how to get their site into an ecological land reuse. We can provide support directly to RPMs and OSCs, and I'm going to briefly touch on each of these and provide you with some examples in my presentation. So I mentioned we've done these eco-forums, and these are held at the regional level, and they provide an opportunity to integrate reuse into the remedy discussion. My division, EPA regional staff, and other agency personnel come together to discuss agency and regional priorities related to ecological revitalizations for that region. This can tie nicely into considering whether these sites can provide playing and learning opportunities at the site. It's typically a day-long event. We work with the region to come up with the agenda. We have interactive activities, innovative dialogue, and panel discussions, with the overall goal of creating advancements in ecological revitalization for the region, strengthening their internal relationships, and, as I mentioned, tailoring the region-specific needs and priorities. We have bring in a variety of participants and speakers. The sessions can include industry professionals, topic area experts. We've had EPA Superfund directors, branch chiefs, remedial project managers, on-scene coordinators, risk assessors, regional council, Superfund redevelopment coordinators, and other regional staff come and present information related to this topic and lead discussions with their region. Uh, We've had very positive feedback from the forums that we have held. Some of the outcomes you see listed here on this slide, but they also can include, we've done some follow-up webinars that are archived here on CLUIN, and we've shared ideas with a national audience. We've strengthened our regional collaboration as well as collaboration across the regions. And with headquarters, we participated and brainstormed on in-situ remediation options for several site-specific issues that were brought up at some of these meetings. In EPA Region 7, we focused on providing an overview of ecological revitalization, whereas when we went to Region 9, our EcoForum provided more in-depth technical information regarding using soil amendments on large mining sites in the region, since that was one of their major topics of concern. We also do reuse planning. We can help regional remedial project managers and site stakeholders consider opportunities for planning and carrying out ecological revitalization projects during the cleanup process. We can help with planning for specific recreational and educational elements related to ecological revitalization of a property. Some of the general steps that can be taken when planning and carrying out eco-revitalization, you want to determine the pre-disturbance conditions as a reference to use in planning the ecological revitalization work. A property inventory can help provide a baseline for the ecological inventory of biodiversity at a site, including looking at the species composition and vegetative community structure. It can just be used as a guide in your ecological revitalization planning. And in some cases, appropriately designed ecological revitalization might be self-sustaining and require little or no maintenance after you've established it. O&M may be required and depend on the type of cleanup as well as the ecological revitalization component. O&M can typically involve inspection, sampling, and analysis, routine maintenance, maybe some small repairs, and any reporting as necessary. So this is a site example of some work that we did support at the East Helena site in Montana in Region 8. It's a great example of how we provided technical assistance and reuse planning in action. And Frank Costanzi, who you'll hear from next, was also part of this effort. We provided technical assistance, such as on-site consultation. We participated in a day-long charrette that was held with the community to integrate technical expertise into the remedy and reuse considerations. And we also used our interagency agreement to do some soil sampling and consulting on some of the results. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative provided the support and regional funding to help develop a vision for redevelopment in this community. And goals of the reuse planning project were to look at the land use and identify a vision for growth in East Helena that considered some of the undeveloped land that was in the area. And there was also a concern with the cultural heritage of the site. And, you know, developing a reuse plan with the vision of celebrating the history of East Helena and the culture. And then they were also interested in identifying habitat restoration and recreational opportunities around the Prickly Pear Creek that was runs through the site. And some of the recreational opportunities were to include regional trail network and creating the area as a recreational destination for tourism. So in 2010, EPA's Region 2 and headquarters sponsored a reuse assessment for the GM Messina site. And the point was to clarify the reuse goals, identify potential future uses for the site that are consistent with the proposed cleanup, and to facilitate discussion regarding ownership and long-term stewardship options. So this reuse assessment helped determine if the site could accommodate a mix of commercial, industrial, tourism-related uses, and open space for the public. And it could, and this would be a reuse plan to be phased over time. And the reuse assessment also provided the community, the local government, the site stakeholders with recommendations to best facilitate a successful redevelopment at the site using both public and private funds. And as a result of this work, in 2012, the state of New York awarded a $360,000 brownfield grant to the North Country Redevelopment Task Force that's going to be used to conduct market and infrastructure feasibility studies for the redevelopment plan that was developed for the property. One thing that we've done relatively recently is we've worked with Region 4 to create an eco-curriculum framework to help integrate some of the scientific aspects of the cleanup and the remedial components into a curriculum for the local schools. And some of the activities that we're including in this curriculum is highlighting ecological topics that can supplement existing EPA curricula. We're looking at offering a variety of educational materials for students of all ages and their teachers. We see this as a learning series that would be part of the site's eco-curriculum. We can build it from existing EPA Superfund classroom activities and environmental lesson plans. So we've sponsored a pilot project to develop a site-specific Superfund environmental education curriculum for an elementary school that's next to the Picayune Wood Treating Superfund site, which is located, as I mentioned, in Region 4, which is in Mississippi in this case. And I'm going to take a little bit more of my time today and talk to you about what this eco-curriculum pilot project is going to look like. And the photos here on this slide are just some examples of outdoor classrooms and learning opportunities. So this is a 32-acre Picayune Wood Treating Superfund site located in Picayune, Mississippi. There was various timber and lumber-related operations at this site from early 1900s till about 1999. The site was listed on the National Priority List in 2004. EPA and Mississippi's Department of Environmental Quality have investigated the site to conditions and taken steps to clean up the site so that it's protected of people and the environment from the contamination. And EPA has excavated the contaminated soil identified on residential properties near the site and placed the soil in a fenced area on site. In 2005, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative supported reuse planning at this site, and the soil cleanup was completed in 2013, and EPA sponsored a second planning process to update the future use plan, and as part of this update, stakeholders identified a number of short-term and long-term action steps that they wanted to see to transition the site into reuse. The picture here is a view of the portion of the site that could possibly provide forest and wetland trail opportunities. The site consists of mostly flat, undeveloped land. Active manufacturing and light industrial facilities border the site to the north. There's an elementary school, residential community, vacant land, and a small community park that are bordering the site to the south. And the site is in close proximity to the downtown, and the primary site access is via a main street. This map is showing some of the remedial features that need to be considered during reuse planning and implementation. So in addition to just looking at the remedial components, land use restrictions will be placed on the affected properties to ensure the remedial components stay protected and to prohibit any residential use and groundwater access. So as I mentioned, we supported a reuse planning assessment for the site. And following the completion of soil cleanup activities, a second planning process was initiated to update the future use plan based on the remedial features of the site, what the community wanted, and the surrounding land uses. So to initiate the planning process, there was a working session held with the city staff, elected officials, to review a draft suitability assessment, refine the reuse framework, and identify potential funding sources, and refine the Superfund environmental education curriculum. So in July of 2013, EPA hosted a public availability session to answer questions about the site cleanup and also solicit input on the revised reuse framework. And the framework reflects the ideas and recommendations of city staff, elected officials, and community members. And it's being used as a tool for returning the site to a safe and productive use. It also offers a flexible long-term planning tool that can be adapted as new information becomes available. And the pictures here are various stakeholders and community meetings that were held during the planning process. So the city representatives expressed an interest in acquiring ownership of the site from the state. During the working session, city staff and stakeholders identified a few goals to guide the future planning of this for reuse of the site. The first thing they wanted was access and circulation. They wanted to ensure that the school access to the site is secure and public access is restricted during school hours and activities. They wanted to improve the pedestrian and vehicle access to the main street. They wanted to improve the connectivity through on-site well-lit biking and walking trails. And they also wanted to be able to connect to downtown and Main Street. Another thing they were interested in was creating a community hub to support community activities and programs, maybe a community center, pool, splash pad, farmers market, outdoor amphitheater, and gathering and play spaces. Some of the other recreational features they were interested in are soccer fields, basketball courts, dog park, skateboard park, disc golf. And like East Helena, they were interested in incorporating some of the heritage as part of their tourism opportunities, you know, having interpretive kiosks, walking trails, just to celebrate the area's history. And then lastly, they're interested in open space environmental education because they want to enhance and connect the recreational opportunities at this site through trails, gathering areas, and habitat viewing areas. And then also provide these educational opportunities for the school children. And also provide some public environmental education programs. And lastly, as part of that, to support and promote ecotourism opportunities. So the reuse planning process at this site resulted in developing a concept plan, and that's what you see here on this slide. The plan illustrates how the reuse goals can be integrated on the site to align with the remedial considerations and other site characteristics. Once implemented, the concept plan will benefit the community by providing recreational and community amenities so that they can connect this site to downtown and surrounding neighborhoods. And the future use of an adjacent property that's currently for sale might also present additional opportunities for supporting some of those connections and the reuse concept plan goals. So one of the major stakeholder focuses for the site was the environmental education reuse component. And this is due to the location adjacent to the Southside Elementary School. The feeling that the site can offer a unique outdoor classroom opportunity where students can experience hands-on learning about environmental issues. So our office here at headquarters has been able to supplement a Superfund redevelopment funding opportunity to provide some technical assistance to develop an environmental education curriculum for the site and local schools. We've been discussing potential environmental education learning ideas and considerations with the Picayune School Board and the Southside Elementary School staff. An online outline curriculum has been developed based on some existing EPA curriculum and Mississippi's Common Core standards, and it's being updated based on input and ideas from the school board at this time. But some of the possible educational activities are going to cover ecological aspects of the site, as well as the site history, cleanup and reuse of the site from a Superfund perspective. So the stakeholders at this site identified a number of near-term and long-term action steps for the site at their working session, and the state and city are working to transfer ownership of the site to the city. Other action steps include continued coordination for planning and development of educational components for the site associated to the eco-curriculum, defining the site maintenance roles and responsibilities, placing institutional controls on the property, identification of funding opportunities, and exploration of opportunities for the, like I mentioned, the site that's adjacent to the property. So some of the early reuse implementation is probably going to focus on access from the main street and downtown, connecting and enhancing the open space and environmental education opportunities, establishing short-term parking, and some later phasing might include supporting some of those community hub activities. So my division is taking lesson learned from this site so far and trying to use it to develop a national eco-curriculum framework. And this can be a tool that can be used to support Superfund site stakeholders and other remedial project managers as they consider and plan and implement an environmental education component as part of their ecological reuse and revitalization of a site that they're cleaning up. And when we're finished, we're hoping to have this national eco-curriculum framework available on the EcoTools website that I mentioned to you at the beginning of my presentation, which I think there's a link on the next slide. And with that, I'm finished with my presentation. I think we wanted to take a quick poll of our audience members. We're just curious if you have recreational reuse opportunities at your Superfund sites. If you could just answer a couple of these questions that have been brought up on the main slide, below the main slide deck. We're just curious to see what those online are working on and if anything is similar or other new types of reuse that we're not aware of to this point, because as the Superfund redevelopment coordinator has said, there's no use that can be left out, and we're always finding new opportunities for reusing Superfund sites. So with that, I thank you for your attention and your participation in the survey, and I look forward to our next presenters.
Actually, Michelle, I think we're going to take a quick break for some questions before we move on to the next presenter. And just an indicator for those people who are filling out the survey below, it does look like three-quarters of the audience have used it at multiple Superfund sites, and there's another part to the question to the right. If you can type up a text explanation or examples of what types of reuse you're doing at your site, that'll also help us understand what others are doing. Just a reminder, if you're in the middle of typing up a question in the Q&A, you can go ahead and continue to do so. If you haven't submitted one in, that Q&A window will remain open throughout that broadcast. I'm going to go through and just start reading through a couple of those questions and see if anything else pops up for you. One of our questions came in, and someone asked if there was a national reuse summit that either is held and that they could participate in, or if they only happened on a site-by-site or region-specific basis?
As far as on a national level, I mean, the thing that comes to mind is the Brownfields meeting that happens. Not necessarily yearly. I think they're on a year-and-a-half schedule now. But we do, you know, working with our these reuse plans that you've seen here and these projects are done site-specifically with support from the remedial project managers and the Superfund redevelopment coordinators in the region to come up with specific plans for specific site uses. I guess I don't know if Fran or Tom knows of any national meeting. I'm not aware of anything other than Brownfields. And then, like I said, on these site-specific issues, we come in and really hone in on what the community needs are and what the remediation goals are and how the site can be put into reuse.
Yeah, Michelle, this is Tom Bloom. We also have the National Association for Remedial Project Managers every year, where we normally do at least one or two presentations on reuse. And also, that is a kind of a national conference.
Yep, that's a good point. Thank you.
Excellent. We did have another question that was really targeting how they could get some of the assistance that you outlined in the case studies. Some attendees are asking if there are reuse grants they can apply for, or how does one get TISTI and SRI support funded?
And this is Fran. If people can hold up, I think that's a part of what I talk about little bit.
Okay. So I guess Michelle will postpone an answer to that until
Fran. Yes, I can add something if we need to after Fran's presentation, but we don't want to steal her thunder.
Okay. And then the last question I see sitting here in the queue, you talked about the ecological curriculum that you're working on. Mm-hmm. Are those materials available somewhere, or will they be shared after your pilot project is done?
They will be available after our pilot project is done, and you'll see them on the EcoTools website, and I'm pretty confident we'll probably be doing some internet seminars on them and talking more about the specifics of what we learn as we get further along with the Picayune site. But, yeah, as I mentioned, there is a plan to create a national framework based on the pilot that we're running at Picayune so that we can use that to develop eco-curriculums at other Superfund sites.
All right, excellent. Well, I want to thank Michelle for joining us, and let's move over to our next presentation. In just a moment, we're going to be joined here by Fran Costanzi, who's been a Superfund Remedial Project Manager for the EPA out in, I believe, it's Region 8 since 1989. For the first 9 years, she actually worked out in Region 3 based in Philadelphia, and then she's been out in Denver since 1998. During this time, Fran has worked on a variety of fund and enforcement lead projects, where she's been the RPM at several Superfund sites involving redevelopments, and she's also worked on the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, and also assists site teams with the reuse of Superfund sites. I think I need to jump us back to the kickoff of Fran's materials. I apologize here. And Fran, whenever you're ready, feel free to begin.
Thanks, Jean. I'm ready. So we have found in the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative that sharing examples of successful projects and lessons learned is one of the most effective tools for promoting reuse. It inspires stakeholders with opportunities and vision. It shares tools and resources to help facilitate changes at sites, and also provides hope to communities that are struggling to find a silver lining after they find out they have a Superfund contaminated property in their midst. So this next slide has a link on it to our main webpage, and on that page you'll find that the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative has a number of tools and additional resources. You can take a look at the reuse planning project examples and get more information about the reuse planning process in the community support area of the website. We've also collected both national and site-specific redevelopment economic data, which is always interesting to learn how going through this process has changed from before to after, because most of our Superfund sites were often economic engines in a community where they were factories or smelters that provided to the tax base, provided jobs, and then fell on hard times. So there's information about when it's cleaned up and gone to a future use, how in almost every case the economy and tax base has rebounded. We also have fact sheets on highlighting successful reuse, technical reports, in-depth case studies, the site-wide ready for anticipated use performance measure, and also various guidance documents. These resources highlight tools used at various sites and provide examples for both remedial project managers and their teams, as well as community members, and present possible strategies for overcoming barriers to reuse. So I encourage you to go to this website and explore and take a look at these materials. Melissa Friedland and Frank Avisado, who are our contacts at EPA headquarters, are also a great resource. And we have Superfund redevelopment coordinators in each region. For example, I'm the regional coordinator for Region 8, which is based in Denver. And Tom, who will speak next, is the Region 5 coordinator out of the Chicago office. I believe you can find all of our names on the headquarters website, the link that I've given you. But feel free to get in touch with the SRI coordinator if you have any questions, because we're here to help and we really try to. And this is the first partial answer to the question, because if you want to know about funding, I would contact the project manager that you're dealing with for whatever Superfund site you have. But you can also contact the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in that regional office, and we will circle back around and make sure we're working with the site team to talk about what resources might be available for that particular site. So keep in mind that we also work closely with other EPA programs, and we're often able to facilitate collaboration between the EPA site team and site stakeholders. So pictured on this website, you can see one of the things, a web success story, and also a return to use demonstration project fact sheet, a reuse planning map, and the SRI website homepage and link at the bottom. So it's very important to remember that every site has a different success story, and every site is unique, both in usually the site itself, the community, and having unique needs. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative has tools that can help fit these individual situations. I'd like to talk a bit about some specific tools that we found most helpful when planning for and implementing recreation and educational reuse. Key tools for recreational and educational site reuse fall into the three following general categories: outreach materials, technical reports and guidance, and also reuse planning. And we have pictures of some of those here on your screen. The outreach materials that the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative develops are a variety of tools that can promote information sharing of successful reuse projects, as well as the reuse planning process and technologies used at these sites. These tools can be videos, fact sheets, handouts, and even webinars such as this one. On a fairly regular basis, we host a free webinar series that discusses different types of reuse that are possible and shares how particular Superfund sites have become reuse success stories. We have several great outreach tools that speak specifically to recreational and educational reuse. Our recreational reuse fact sheet, reuse success story fact sheets, and our Reclaiming Recreational Opportunities Through the Reuse of Superfund Sites video, which we will look at in a minute. But the recreational use fact sheet provides an overview of recreational reuse at Superfund sites nationwide, including key considerations and reuse success stories. The return to use and web success story fact sheet, and I know a lot of these words blend together because we have reuse or redevelopment in almost everything, but the reuse, return to use and web success story fact sheet highlights a number of sites that have been redeveloped into parks with playgrounds, trails, and other recreational amenities. That handout provides details on everything from site ownership, from ownership to site restrictions, to EPA's role in the process and best practices. We've also hosted several webinars that look at recreational reuse, and one in particular focuses on reuse at soccer fields, highlighting EPA's partnership with the U.S. Soccer Foundation. And what we found is all of these things can help site teams and communities develop their vision for what the future can be for their particular site that they're working with. So I'd like now for us to take just a few minutes and watch Superfund Redevelopment Initiative's Reclaiming Recreational Opportunities Through the Reuse of Superfund Sites.
Okay, we're going to play the video back online through Adobe Connect. The audio for the video should play back on your computer speakers. If you're having any problems with that audio, again, check your local volume settings. Make sure you're not muted out. We also have included a direct link where you can play it back from the Superfund website if you have any problems with our live broadcast.
The reuse potential of Superfund sites is far-reaching. Today, sites are being reused for virtually every type of land use, from residential, commercial, and industrial land uses to parks, farmland, and public facilities. Over 100 communities across the country are using formerly contaminated properties to provide a range of recreational and ecological amenities. These properties are taking on new life in the form of playgrounds, ball fields, hiking and biking trails, sports complexes, golf courses, model airplane flying fields, and ecological areas like wildlife sanctuaries, nature preserves, and wetlands. Reusing these sites allows for properties that would otherwise be left vacant to be reclaimed in a way that improves the health and well-being of the surrounding community. From sites such as Auburn Road Landfill and Taylor Road Landfill, which are now flying fields for Academy of Model Aeronautics Clubs, to Pemmico Maywood, which is part of the Los Angeles River Greenway Project and provides playgrounds and athletic fields for area residents. Communities are finding inspiring ways to bring new life and promote healthy lifestyles at Superfund sites. The 121-acre HOD Landfill Superfund site in Antioch, Illinois, accepted municipal and industrial wastes from 1963 to 1984. When the waste management operated landfill closed in 1984, the 51-acre landfill area was covered with a clay cap. Undeveloped, uncontaminated buffer land comprised the remaining 70 acres of the landfill property. Due to rapid population growth in the community and the site's location adjacent to the Antioch Community High School, the community worked with EPA and waste management to encourage a future use that would support multiple recreational land use needs. Between 2005 and 2008, the citizens of Antioch saw the construction of a wealth of new opportunities, 12 tennis courts, soccer, field hockey, football, baseball, and other athletic practice fields. In addition, a wetlands area located at the site is now being used as an environmental education resource for area schools. EPA worked with the community by supporting reuse planning, discussing issues relating to site safety, and linking the community to the U.S. Soccer Foundation. The foundation donated equipment for the new soccer fields. A new chapter is beginning in the storied history of the Clark Fork and Blackfoot Rivers in western Montana, home to the ancestors of the Bitterroot Salish, Ponderay, and Kootenai tribes. The region's remarkable fishery and other natural resources have sustained communities for generations. From the 1860s until the late 20th century, the area was also part of one of the richest mining regions in the world. Those operations generated mining and milling wastes that have led to one of the largest hazardous waste cleanups in the country. EPA worked with local communities and federal, state, and tribal partners on a coordinated approach that linked remediation, restoration, and redevelopment at the Milltown Reservoir Sediments Superfund site. Assisted by EPA, the communities developed a reuse plan that called for the creation of a state park with trails, river access, wildlife habitat, and interpretive areas celebrating the region's history and heritage. Today, the confluence of the Clark Fork and Blackfoot Rivers flows freely for the first time in a century. More than 3 million tons of contaminated sediments have been removed, and the restoration of the Clark Fork Rivers channel and floodplain will be completed by 2012. Many Superfund sites are located in communities that lack recreational areas and have limited space for development. EPA can work with communities in a number of ways to support recreational reuse, such as providing community planning services, sharing best practices and lessons learned from communities who pursued similar challenges, connecting groups interested in recreational use to supportive partners, and issuing environmental status reports that explain how these sites can be used safely. Recycled sites provide economic, environmental, and social benefits, and each one of these sites can become a catalyst to help revitalize a neighborhood and strengthen a community.
That video that you just saw, many others are available on the website link that I gave you earlier, and you're absolutely more than welcome, encouraged to download them for your site team, for community meetings. We just find that seeing other possibilities, especially when you're near the beginning of a process and it just feels like it's going to be a very long time that you'll be involved in investigating a Superfund site, just being able to see some vision for the end result is extraordinarily helpful. So the videos are there to look at and also to download and share. The second category of tools that's helpful is to productive recreational and educational reuse is technical reports. So part of the website is dedicated to these technical or how-to reports. These reports provide more detailed information about the technologies used to return hazardous waste sites to productive reuse while ensuring that protectiveness of the remedy is maintained. Three of our how-to reports that we currently have speak directly to recreational reuse. They detail specific advantages and considerations for developing abandoned mine lands into recreational areas and how sites with waste left in place, such as landfills and other sites, have been returned to recreational reuse while remaining protective of human health and the environment, and technical details related to planning, designing, and constructing golf courses on Superfund sites. These reports are available in the Reuse Technical Reports section on the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative's website. Our third category is reuse planning. Reuse planning enables communities to work with EPA and other partners to integrate remedy and reuse considerations and remove unnecessary barriers to reuse, maximizing the opportunities for recreational and educational reuse and other types as well, though this webinar is focused on recreational and educational. So each year, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative sets aside a limited amount of resources to provide in-kind reuse planning services through the assistance of a national contractor with expertise in the reuse of contaminated sites. And so this is one of the ways that we can provide funding, but it's not a grant. It's actually providing a very skilled contractor resource. In addition, EPA regional offices may also be able to provide some resources. And we have, as Michelle was speaking, other resources we can tap into from her office for certain things. Land available for recreation is becoming increasingly hard to come by within many existing communities, and having that ability to have recreational resources is so important and enhances a community. Planning to reuse Superfund sites for recreational and educational purposes can provide vital resources to underserved communities and link together existing parks and natural areas, creating regional amenities. Reuse planning also helps establish realistic community expectations for future use of sites. It can include a market analysis as well as an evaluation of site conditions. Commercial uses may be viable at sites in high-demand areas with remedies that can support unrestricted use. For the many other sites, however, recreational and educational reuses provide a way to reclaim vacant land and address the health and well-being of the surrounding community. Successful redevelopment projects are the result of people working together, and we found this over and over again. It's rare for one entity to be able to cause successful reuse to happen, but it usually happens as a result of people coming and working together. Reuse planning provides a way to bring everyone to the table to discuss issues, opportunities, and next steps, and to sustain meaningful community engagement. Here we have pictured an SRI-funded community coalition to plan for the future of communities of North Birmingham. The coalition in this case brought together residents, community representatives, and government agencies, including EPA, to address issues of environmental cleanup, enforcement, and community investment. So resources for remedial project managers and others. to work on reuse. So to initiate planning projects, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative provides what we call regional seed startup funds for projects around the country. What this is the contractor support that has expertise in reuse planning. And through this work, we have seen that well-run, community-based reuse planning has the potential to dramatically improve community relations and the public's perception of the agency, to streamline the remedial process by clarifying the site's, the term of art is reasonably anticipated future land use, and integrating the site's remedial strategy with that reasonably anticipated future land use, and to bring the agency and communities together around the most cost-effective remedies that produce the greatest long-term value for local communities. Regional seeds are resources provided by the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative to communities at the request of the EPA regional staff. The seed concept provides an initial investment to bring the right stakeholders to the table, clarify remedy constraints, and outline suitable reuse options for the local community to pursue. Additional resources to complete the regional seed process are then provided by the region if more funding is needed. Once the reuse planning process gains momentum, communities can leverage the initial regional seed investment with local resources to continue the process of transforming the Superfund site into productive reuse. Superfund Redevelopment Initiative recognizes there's no one-size-fits-all strategy to make reuse happen. Therefore, the initiative offers a number of different types of regional seeds to support reuse. Recent focus areas have included renewable energy, recreational and educational reuse, area-wide planning, and green infrastructure. So, coming up, now that you know a little bit more about the tools and resources, Tom will be taking over to dive into some case studies. But Jean, back to you first, I think.
Yes. So again, just a gentle reminder, if you do have questions or comments for our presenters, you can submit those at any time in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. We did have just a few questions that popped in while you were speaking, Fran. And I think you may have touched on this, but perhaps a little bit of clarification. Someone wanted to know if there were meeting facilitators that they can use to help with their reuse planning. So I guess the natural extension is, if there are, how do they tap into them? Which one of those funding options would they be using?
There are. There's several different options that the remedial project manager and site team can explore. As a part of doing reuse planning, we provide meeting support and development for the charrette or visioning process that I think Michelle mentioned briefly. We've also, if people are not quite to that point, we've also brought in some facilitation to help the community and other stakeholder group get to the point where they're ready for actually a visioning session. And we've also done things using other tools, other support mechanisms, such as technical support for communities. It's a different contract where we can bring in that contract support to help with education and also some facilitation support. And EPA has internal resources as well. We often have a number of people in the regional offices trained in facilitation. So a wide variety of tools based on the specific situation that could be used. And Tom or Michelle, I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
Perhaps we'll get Michelle's comments in a moment. We did have another question. You had mentioned that there were regional coordinators, such as yourself and Tom, that work on Superfund redevelopment. Are there state reuse coordinators that are similar in your job function, and do you interface with them from EPA down to the state level?
We definitely coordinate with our state counterparts. As of now, there aren't state coordinators designated. We usually work with the EPA RPM and state project manager on a site team. And so now there are some state project managers that have gotten quite a bit of experience. just earlier this year, we recognized, for example, three of the states who have really worked extensively with us on reuse, and we gave out awards at their state meetings for that. But there isn't a designated list of state coordinators at this point.
Okay. And then I think the last question we'll take now before we move on to Tom's presentation, this might offer a comment from everybody. One person wanted to know how you can get comments or engagement from remote communities when you're doing this reuse planning. I think there were a lot of pictures of physical meetings where people showed up. But do you have suggestions or examples where you may have had a geographically dispersed community and physically getting them to show up to that meeting wasn't an option?
I work in the Rocky Mountain West, so we do deal with some areas that are quite remote and rural. So we have a variety of tools that we can use for all of our community involvement activities, not just reuse related, which include website, Facebook, a lot of internet sharing. Though if you're actually going to do something like a charrette or a visioning session, it would probably pay to coordinate that well enough that people could come in for a day to do that. But as far as just getting information out, we find often that people have electronic capabilities in the more remote areas, and that's a possibility. Or we can always go back to the old-fashioned paper as well.
All right, excellent. Well, with that, let's move on to our next presentation. This will be the last presentation of the session today. Our next presenter will be Tom Bloom, who's joining us from EPA Region 5. Tom is the Region 5 Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator and has been working with communities in that region since the start of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative in 1999. He has worked with nearly 100 communities in Region 5 to help consider reuse as part of the cleanup process. I think we're going to go ahead and turn things right over to Tom. So, Tom, if you're on the line and prepared to begin, please feel free.
Okay. This is Tom Bloom, and I'm Region 5 Redevelopment Coordinator, and I'm always looking for ways to promote safe and beneficial reuse of Superfund sites in Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Ohio, and Indiana. And today I'm going to talk about five sites where we have little examples of recreational and educational reuse, and then a little bit more in detail about the Southside Sanitary Landfill where they have recreational and educational reuse at the site. The five sites that I'll touch briefly on are the Butterworth Landfill, the DuPage County Landfill, and I've got a little movie for that one, the PMC Groundwater Site, the Torch Lake Site, and the Kerr-McGee Reed Kepler Park Site. So the first one is the Butterworth Landfill. It's a 120-acre landfill. It's located in Grand Rapids, and we've been working with the City of Grand Rapids for years to redevelop the site. The site was a commingled landfill that accepted regular waste, but then also some industrial waste from about 1950 to 1973, resulting in groundwater and soil contamination. There was also waste drums on the site when we discovered it in the early 80s. The cleanup began in 1990 with the removal of waste drums and soil, and the site's remedy includes a landfill cover and groundwater monitoring, which is ongoing. We got together with the City of Grand Rapids and put together a couple of community charrettes in the early 2000s. Everybody seemed to want a little piece of the site. The BMXers, the skateboarders, the rugby players, the model airplane guys, mostly the fishermen, but mostly recreational users. Also, there is a concern for a connector trail for two bike trails. There's a large system of bike trails to the north and leading up from Grand Rapids to Cadillac, Michigan. And then there's a set of trails to the south that lead from Grand Rapids to Kalamazoo, and with the Butterworth Landfill right in the middle of them. What made it convenient at the Butterworth Landfill was that the haul roads that were put in there, the RPM, the Remedial Project Manager, decided to pave the haul roads instead of putting gravel down and then having to redress the gravel year after year and add more gravel. He saw that it would be more cost effective to put down paved haul roads there. Well, those haul roads worked really good for a connector trail. And in 2009, EPA constructed access extensions to connect the site to the bicycle trail network. And we worked together also to facilitate the use of these access roads for marathon races that happen in Grand Rapids. So this worked out to be a really good opportunity for the local area to use the site. And I believe people, the fishermen, might be in there fishing in the Grand River. And bringing it up to 2013, we've just recently conducted a renewable energy assessment study for the city of Grand Rapids, where we look at different parts of the site and see how they're suitable for a solar field, where the energy could go, who would use it, whether it be used on-site or being sold commercially. And we're moving forward with the city of Grand Rapids on that right now. The next site is the DuPage County Landfill, which is in Warren, Illinois. And I'm going to cue Gene up to start a movie that we put together there about the recreational use at the DuPage County Landfill. Okay, Gene?
And as with the other movie, we're going to play that back online through Adobe. But to hear the audio, you can listen to your computer speakers or with a pair of headphones. We'll share the link.
At the DuPage County Landfill Superfund site in Warrenville, Illinois, remedial actions have addressed contamination at the site, allowing local residents of all ages the opportunity to celebrate a rich selection of year-round recreational uses. But success at what is now the Blackwell Forest Preserve required a great deal of cooperation as well as a lot of forward thinking.
The Blackwell Forest Preserve is a unique study. It was a former gravel pit, and so the concept at that time was to make it a recreational area for the people of DuPage County.
So what they did was they filled in that quarry with solid waste. They operated as a landfill, and they did it in such a way that with in mind that they would create a large mountain out there that they could use for recreational purposes.
The development of the Roy C. Blackwell Forest Preserve solved two things. It was going to provide a premier recreational facility for the residents and also solve the county's solid waste disposal needs. The hill is 40 acres in size, and it's within a complex of 1,372 acres that was assembled through the district's land acquisition program for the purposes of conservation, education, and recreation.
There was some contributors of solid waste that generated not just solid waste, but liquid wastes. And some of those liquid wastes had hazardous constituents in them. And so when they were finished with putting the landfill together and having their mound built up there, they had leachate that leaked out of it.
Earlier sampling found that the site was contaminated with VOCs. EPA went up and we did a site assessment and found that groundwater was the major pathway for the site. And then the EPA put the site on the NPL.
Now, the easy way is to step back and say, we're not going to do anything about it, and let's just close it down and make, just put our heads in the sand and maybe it'll go away. We were very proactive, wanting not to fight, but to take direction from the EPA, see how we could work as a, not in an adversarial position, but in a cooperative position. Both parties had the same goal. We wanted to rectify any problems we had there, because unless we rectified those problems, we couldn't get to step two and provide what we wanted to provide for the people of DuPage County.
And since 1976, Mount Hoy and the Blackwell Forest Preserve have provided a wide variety of publicly accessible recreation and conservation uses.
We learned very early that we could not close off a piece of public property that was usable from the public enjoying it. So it became instantly popular. The boating, trails to hike on, picnic areas, an amphitheater where films could be shown, fishing opportunities. camping, and of course, being that DuPage County is so flat geographically, a hill would be a very attractive feature.
A lot of recreation goes on within Blackwell, and one of the unique features, of course, is Mont Hoy. Within the winter, we have tubing, and that's something that's kind of unusual. And basically, for $4, anyone is able to rent a tube for the day and slide down Mont Hoy as many times as they like.
Mont Hoy is one of two good locations in DuPage County for watching the annual hawk migration that occurs every fall. Here in Illinois, it's pretty flat, and Mont Hoy is high, so we have a nice vista. You'll see more up here than you can down below.
Initially seeded with Eurasian grasses, the surface of the landfill didn't blend in with the landscape. And the Forest Preserve District wanted Mount Hoy to look, feel, and function like a natural part of the ecosystem. The Forest Preserve District has established native vegetation on the surface of the landfill, selecting grasses and plant species that are commonly found in the short grass prairie habitat. The use of native vegetation at landfill sites provides a range of recreational, ecological, and financial benefits.
EPA supports ecological reuse of contaminated sites as part of the larger Superfund redevelopment initiative. When you go in to a site and you want to revegetate the cap, if you do your research in looking and see what the native vegetation, in this case prairie habitat, is, you'll have a better chance of getting the plants established in a way that will have lower maintenance, better growth potential than a monoculture that may not be indigenous to that area or habitat.
I didn't want to stand there and say this doesn't fit. If we did a fescue preserve there, it would just be out of place.
So some of the benefits of using native plants for revegetation of a landfill, you can have a tremendous cost savings in your operation and maintenance. You know, there'll be lower water use. In most cases, it's more beautiful. You'll have flowers as opposed to just some grass species. Using native vegetation creates habitat for your local species. It can also improve the air quality for the community because you'll have less dust if your plants are established well. It's not difficult to revegetate your site with native species.
Plants and trees used on the landfill were selected so that they would not penetrate the landfill cap. There was no worry of uptake by these trees or these plants. The integrity of the landfill was maintained.
To maintain the remedy, it's pretty much what one would do at any landfill. We monitor the gas, we monitor the groundwater, we monitor leachate elevations. Annually, we produce a report on the vegetation, shows what root penetration is. As a forest preserve, we manage prairies on thousands of acres. It's a combination of burning, selective herbicide applications, and actually removal of some very persistent unwanted species. The only extra thing we do on the landfill is some sensitive areas like leachate vaults. We may weed whack around to get rid of the vegetation so there isn't enough fuel.
The unified effort to clean up and restore the DuPage County landfill site has created a public open space that provides multiple community and environmental benefits.
My position has always been, if we have it, let's utilize it. And I think what we did at Blackwell is a perfect example of incorporating all the possible needs of the people and serving all those needs.
What are we going to do with it when it's over? And the answer is, yeah, you can build a park at another Superfund site. You can also build an office complex, you can build whatever you want to build. But you have to look at the community that's around it and say, what does the community want? Not now, but into the future. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're back now, and I just wanted to say about DuPage County Landfill, what it was is the Forest Preserve District took a very proactive stance on this. They wanted to put together, you know, a recreational use. They wanted a hill there, basically. They didn't really want a Superfund site. And when the waste got commingled and we discovered that it was a Superfund site, they worked well with us. There was 1.5 million cubic yards of waste put into this landfill. And I want to say, you know, DuPage County just took that and said, let's, you know, work with the EPA, let's work with the Illinois EPA, let's do what we need to do to make it safe and protective, but also let's keep it in the plan and what we had, what we wanted to do, and to make a hill there so that people could slide down it and could bird watch and do all that. And the place is incredible now. There's, you know, picnicking and camping areas. You saw the Urban Stream Research Center, and there's also, I think, an Olympus scale archery range out there now at the DuPage County landfill. So now what I'm going to do is switch to the PMC groundwater site in Petoskey, Michigan. And this is at the very tip of the lower peninsula of Michigan. The PMC Superfund site was a former industrial area on the lower, in the Little Traverse Bay in Lake Michigan. And the Petoskey Manufacturing Company operated a die-casting plant at the site and improperly disposed of the wastes from casting the process. The results were contaminated groundwater, soil, and it also contaminated the town's municipal well. The EPA placed it on the NPL in 83, and the plans call for removal and disposal of contaminated soil vapor, installation of a soil vapor extraction system, and then institutional controls to make sure that people didn't drink the groundwater until it got cleaned up. The EPA and the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the City of Petoskey and also local developers collaborated with this, and they took the city's visionary effort and used creative financing strategies to transform this area, this industrial zone, into a mixed-use commercial, residential, and recreational waterfront. The site now supports condominiums with fully integrated underground utilities and improved road, parking, lakefront, bicycle path infrastructure. And the number of visitors that enjoy the lakefront scenery and the recreational amenities has increased significantly in the recent years. In addition, the taxable value of the site properties has increased 15 times since PMC operated the facility. And that's something that I think was mentioned earlier in this webinar, is the numbers on some of the sites that are being produced after we redevelop them. It's incredible how many jobs are being created, how much tax revenue is coming back to these blighted areas that once were a center of commerce and that lost that because of the contamination was there and then the cleanup that happened afterwards. My next real quick site is the Torch Lake site. The Torch Lake Superfund site is up in Houghton County, Michigan. That's at the top of the upper peninsula of Michigan. That's that little finger that kind of goes up into Lake Superior. It's called the Keweenaw Peninsula, and it was an intensive copper mining area in the 19th and 20th century. The mines produced over 80% of the nation's copper, but the mine stamp sands and the mine tailings were deposited along waterways up and down that peninsula. So there's several operable units up that make up the Torch Lake site, and the contamination there was copper mill tailings and stamp sands. They looked like moonscapes at one time. Well, the remedy wasn't fairly straightforward with that. We just needed to do a vegetative cover over them so that the stamp sands couldn't blow into the waterways or have any direct contact with it. And so we did that, and after we did that, we wanted to monitor the areas that we revegetated. So we set up a process with the local high school to do monitoring and surveying the project area, and they've been doing that since 2003. We created a model monitoring program in collaboration with the Western Upper Peninsula Center for Science, Mathematics, and Education, Environmental Education, and that helps engage students in the Torch Lake community while providing EPA with necessary data to track the improvements of the soil fertility and the return of plants and birds and mammals to these once moonscape-type areas. In addition to that, we found that a lot of people are going up there and putting up little cabins along the lakefronts where nobody would even consider residing on top of these moonscapes in the past. So this collaborative effort with high school students and is allowing them to, you know, learn necessary skills to perform ecological evaluations, also doing environmental monitoring, and it's helping the agency to keep up with the, you know, progress of the cleanup efforts. The students are enjoying, you know, putting surveys together, and also it helps them to develop public speaking skills and educate the broader community on the progress of the site. I will also have to mention up there that we have the Quincy Smelter, which is one of the last operating smelters in the United States that closed down in 1972, and we deleted it last year, and we're working real hard to redevelop the Quincy Smelter into a docking station for the Ranger 2 ferry boat that goes out to the Isle Royale, and we're working with the National Park District to make that happen at the Quincy Smelter. The Kerr-McGee site is on the west side of Chicago, and it was one of four Kerr-McGee sites that were associated with radioactive waste contamination. The 90-acre property operated as a sand and gravel quarry in the late 1800s. The city of West Chicago purchased it from a local railroad company in 1930 and used it as a community park with a small swimming pool constructed in the 1950s. This area also contained a small municipal landfill, and from 1930 to about 1974, the landfill accepted radioactive tailings from the nearby rare earth facility. The site, the tailings were used for cover material on the landfill every day, and also was provided for fill in a surrounding park. So prior to cleanup activities, the local community expressed interest in redeveloping the property as an aquatic center. So EPA worked with the local park district to do a more focused feasibility study and investigation of the area that they proposed, kind of like streamlining the investigation and putting that area out in front to identify potential areas of contamination and modify, and that helped to modify the building plans for the aquatic center to make it compatible with the site's remedy. Construction started in 1993, and the Prairie Oaks Family Aquatic Center opened on a portion of the site in 1995. Some of that continued on being used while cleanup activities happened between 97 and 2000, and they removed contaminated soil. In 2010, the EPA deleted the site from the NPL, and it's now the site can accommodate unrestricted uses. The redevelopment of Reed Kepler Park now features various sports fields, a skateboard park, two playgrounds, concession stands and pavilions, a 25-acre nature sanctuary, a dog park and parking. And the park is home to the West Chicago Park District Wildcats Youth Football League. So this is what happens when we collaborate with the local stakeholders to put together a successful remediation and reuse of the site. And it helps the community to turn a liability into a valuable recreational asset. So now what I was going to do is talk a little bit more in detail about the south side of the sanitary landfill. This landfill is located in Indianapolis, about 4.5 miles southwest of downtown Indy. It's surrounded by Eagle Creek and the White River on one side. There's a lake on another side, and then there's a limestone quarry bordered to the west. Also running right next to the site is the White River. It's on the west bank of the White River. A little bit more about the site history. Landfill activities began in 71. The local government licensed the north part of the landfill for disposal of solid waste. A second disposal area was excavated 150 feet to the south. They operated with using the cut-and-fill procedure, and in 81 they switched to a method of filling in cells and dumping and spreading cover. The municipal waste was also commingled with industrial and agricultural waste at the site. There is an estimated 4 million cubic yards of waste, including coal tar, asbestos, iron oxide, clear, fire sludge, and waste paint disposed of in the landfill. And about 84 EPA contractors did an inspection of the site, found out that the groundwater was contaminated with arsenic, iron, manganese, cadmium, chromium, and silver, and nickel. And it was put on the NPL in March of 1989. It was proposed in June of 86. This, you got to consider, this landfill is continued to operate, and it is continuing to operate right now. And it operated throughout the cleanup activity, so open lines of communications between all the stakeholders was really important to make this thing work. What happened was in 1985, the operators of the landfill signed an agreement with the State Board of Health to correct the drainage problems that were identified at the landfill. And then in 86, they signed an order with the Indiana Department of Environmental Quality to construct a hydraulic cutoff barrier slurry wall and collect the leachate in order to isolate the groundwater from beneath the landfill and the surrounding, from beneath the landfill and not let it release into the surrounding aquifer. In addition to that, they were going to put a monitoring network, cover the landfill, putting post-closure and closure procedures together, and establish funds for closing and post-closure activities at the landfills. So what happened after that was we put it on the EPA, I believe, let me look at my notes here, put it on the NPL. But then since the work was already being done through this order with Indiana Department of Environmental Quality, we did the investigation and we kind of determined that everything that we would have wanted to be done through the Superfund process, the feasibility study, and coming up with an alternative to correct the problems out there was being taken care of by this order. And early on, there was an interest for recycling the on-site landfill gases that were produced. So what the EPA did was they kind of backed out after the RAFS stage, and they concluded that the remedial measures implemented as part of the 1986 order, the slurry wall and the leachate collection system, were adequately protecting the surrounding media from the landfill contamination. So a ROD was signed a couple of years after the RI documenting the existing remedial measures stating that they were sufficient to protect human health and the environment, and then a no further action remedy was selected under CERCLA, under Superfund. That enabled the EPA to delete the site in July of 1997. So some of the early on-site uses were green uses on-site. They used the methane, recovered it to heat they put 100 landfill gas recovery wells in, and they used the landfill gas to heat an on-site maintenance shop and to power the landfill's liquid pumping system, and got the idea of how about let's supply some of this landfill gas for energy in the surrounding businesses. And that's where we come up to the first user of the landfill gas, which is the Crossroads Greenhouse. It's a 6.5-acre greenhouse, which is right next door to the landfill. They produce over 400,000 poinsettias and bedding plants and hanging baskets plants annually. It's one of the largest methane-powered greenhouses in the United States, and they pull more than 2.2 million cubic feet of landfill gas from the landfill every day since 1989. When you go for a tour of the landfill, they take you to the Crossroads Greenhouse afterwards. Once again, I said we were able to delete the site in 97, kind of not skipping the process, but realizing that the remedial process was already being put in place through this order with the state and with the State Board of Health. And that kind of helped open up a private and public partnership of the users for the electricity that would be generated or for the methane that would be coming off the landfill. And this next slide shows that. There's the Southside Sanitary Landfill, and the Rolls-Royce Granger Energy LLC used it. This is shortly after the deletion of the site. Granger Energy in 1998 signed a multi-year contract with Southside Sanitary Landfill to obtain landfill gas from the site. They use the landfill gas for their boiler and generator fuels. This is a very nice public-private partnership, and it saves Rolls-Royce over $2 million in avoided fuel costs annually, and it also helps reduce greenhouse gas emissions of more than 20 tons per year. Vertellus Specialties of Indianapolis is also a customer to the landfill gas from the site, and they use it for boiler fuel at one of the facilities close by. Vertellus Specialties is kind of important because just recently they partnered with Hanwha Q Cells at one of our other sites, the Riley Tar site, and put together a 10.8 megawatt solar field on there, and they're generating electricity for the local area to use. They also received a Region 5's Renew Award a couple of months ago for being good stewards of renewable use of energy and all like that. So today also we have along the Southside Sanitary Landfill is the Buffer Park Golf Course, which it's called Buffer Park because it's the buffer between the neighborhood and the landfill. And what's kind of unique about this is anybody that lives in this neighborhood can use this golf course for free. It's a 9-hole golf course, and I guess they do pretty good there with the businesses. And when you go to visit the site, you'll also notice along the sides of the golf course that the owner is grazing longhorn cattle. They kind of look a little out of place because you think you might have to be in Texas to see something like that, but it is rather unique to see the cattle grazing along the landfill. Here's another picture of the golf course and the grounds. And now I'm coming to the educational reuse at the center. The alternative energy uses at the landfill provide excellent learning opportunities for local schools. In 2003, the landfill donated land for on-site to use by the school board for outside educational environmental education. They provide tours to approximately 6,000 students per year, and most of those students are local students from third grade and above, but they also host university classes, civic groups, and even a large number of conventioners that come into Indianapolis every year. The tour lasts about an hour and a half and begins with a 25-minute video that describes the landfill in general and some of the features of the south site in particular. And then it ends up, they put people in a vehicle and they take them over to the Crossroads greenhouse to show how some of the methane is being used at the greenhouse. Local school classes take field trips, you know, all year round when they're in school as part of their science and civics curriculum to experience 3 R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle. And I wanted to say that the Southside Landfill facility has also developed classroom activities when teachers can't get the kids to the landfill that deal with landfill science, and have games and puzzles that teachers can use in the classroom when, like I said, they can't go on field trips. In addition to that, in the summer months, I believe they have a course on teaching the teachers. So teachers can come to their visitor center, their educational center there, and learn more about landfill science and methane generation and all like that. So it's a really good example of recreational and educational reuse at this landfill. When we talk about the numbers that I was talking about economic impacts, and what I wanted to do is just show some numbers that the Crossroad greenhouse generates more than these are 2011 numbers, by the way, $530,000 in annual sales, and employs eight people and contributes approximately $196,000 in employment income to the local community annually. Wait, I've got a slide on this. The Buffer Park Golf Course generates about $500,000 annually in revenue. It employs about 20 people and contributes approximately $366,000 in employment income to the local community. Southside Sanitary Landfill employs about 25 people a year, supplying approximately $186,000 in annual income to the local community. And the landfill receives about 900,000 tons of waste per year. So some of the lessons that we learned with this one is that open lines of communication is very important throughout the process. Talking to the landfill owners, talking to IDEM, talking to the health department, and getting everybody on board in a collaborative effort, not a negotiation, but a collaboration, was what I think helped out at this point here, at this site here. Also, the fact that Superfund realized that the remedial process was being handled through other means and deciding to jump back and let those means take over and saying that we don't need to duplicate effort here and do our thing, I think that also helped out with the reuse of the landfill. And so you can see from the slides here, you know, that we need to bring discussions to the site early and to the table early so that we don't run into some major challenges later on when we're talking about reusing the landfills. And there's my contact information. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, please give me a call. I've been in the business for 14 years, and I always like to talk. Okay, any questions?
Well, thank you, Tom, for that presentation. Sorry, got an echo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry about that. We can continue to receive questions submitted electronically. So if you're about to type up a question in the Q&A window in the lower right corner, please go right ahead. We did have one question while we're waiting to see if anything else comes in. That I think, Tom, you did talk about this, but I'll pose it to you to see if you might be able to attack it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And this question asks, have you had a problem explaining how recreational reuse will create a tax base? It seems like many communities would rather see commercial or industrial use return to provide actual jobs rather than building a park which provides recreational reuse. And I know you had mentioned that a lot of jobs can come when you do this, but have you had trouble communicating that, or how do you explain where the funding and money and tax base and jobs come into play when you go with educational reuse?
That's a great question, Jean. I mean, when we go out and we do our community information gathering, that's the first thing that comes out is normally if there was a commerce that happened there before, like a factory that employed a lot of people and it's shut down now, that's the first thing that the community and the local stakeholders want. You know, can we get some more jobs out here? Can we generate more revenue out here? A lot of times the market isn't there yet, or the economy isn't there yet. So what can we do with the property in the meantime? I mean, if Target doesn't want to pick it up, or if a local private person doesn't want to pick it up for doing commercial or industrial types of uses out there, what could be a good use of the property in the meantime? And a lot of times that's what we come up with. We come up with recreational uses. Now, recreational uses aren't necessarily tax generators. However, they do generate certain taxes, and especially when you talk to larger cities and work with their park districts. At the waste management landfill that we're in Michigan City, we're putting up zip lines. Well, that's a form of revenue that will be coming in for the people that own that landfill. In addition to that, the areas surrounding it, like at HOD landfill, when that was a landfill and it wasn't a recreational area, the property values and everything that goes on around the landfill was zero, was nothing. People couldn't sell their houses. And once we turned it into a recreational park and people saw other people using it, some of the stigma went away, some of the liability concerns went away, and all of a sudden that area started booming around the edge of the landfill. So that might be an intangible benefit of bringing back recreational reuses. So there are certain recreational reuses that can generate revenue. It's not necessarily a lot of money, not like a, you know, major factory that would be in there, but right now major factories aren't coming in and doing what they used to be doing. So a lot of times some of our reuses are phased. Well, we can do it recreationally now and set it up later on if we do have something that would be a higher use, a more obtainable use later on.
If I could add, this is Fran. We've started to look at this as well, and one of the things I talked about was the economic analysis. So this is in process. You can't yet find it on the website, though I hope it will be up there within the next month or two. We did an economic analysis of the California Gulch recreational use area, and this is near Leadville, Colorado, high up in the mountains, You saw in the video some pictures of the bike path, the soccer fields, and also thanks to the Superfund cleanup, the mining contamination has been cleaned up to the point where it actually now has the river fishable. So we're in the process of doing an economic analysis to show. And for that region, there aren't a lot of jobs in that area. It's very high up in the Rocky Mountains. So as a recreational resource, that's one of the reasons that people go to that part of the Rocky Mountains. And now they can do more amenities such as fishing and boating that weren't possible before. So we're working to capture that with an economic analysis. So sometimes, you know, that is a very good jobs resource as well. It's not just a park.
Yeah, Fran, I wanted to say that too, because I can remember another site, you know, where it might not necessarily be the recreational use on the site, but it's the recreational use of the site in the surrounding area that supports that. I'm thinking of one site where we had a 9-hole frisbee golf course on the site, and they wanted to expand it to 18 holes because then they could hold tournaments there for frisbee golf. Well, once they were able to do that, then you've got your hotels being filled up, your gas stations being used, your restaurants being used. So there is an intangible benefit from that recreational use of using that for an 18-hole golf course.
Yeah, exactly, Tom. And, you know, another one which was in one of the videos was the Milltown Reservoir. So that area now is becoming a state park, which, as you just said, will bring in people as a destination where they will need supporting things, restaurants, gas stations, hotels, all of that. So, you know, that's part of what we're doing in trying to think through and help communities' vision.
All right, excellent. We did have another question come in, and I think you guys were starting to hint at this. Maybe you don't have specific data, but someone wants to know, are there stats on reuse types? Are certain recreational reuse situations more common than others? If so, why or why not?
My guess is that really varies depending on the area. And I don't know specific stats on the number that we have. I think we do try to compile when we find an example. We compile it, but, you know, it can be everything from a little park to a recreational trail. It could really vary, and every site's very different. And you can read a lot of the different examples on the web page to see what makes sense. But Tom, did you want to add to that?
Well, mainly, you know, when we information gather from local stakeholders, that's when we can find out what types of recreational uses might be beneficial to the area. They might have, you know, 5 schools in the area and only 1 or 2 playgrounds. So, yes, that would benefit the area to have a playground there. Or, you know, certain other things that, you know, could be used to help bring people to the community and enjoy their local areas. But I don't know whether we have any statistics on whether, you know, a soccer field reuse is better than tennis courts, is better than playgrounds. You know, I think it's
well,
specific to the area.
Yeah, and I think the way we approach it is we don't actually think of one being a better use or a higher use. It's whatever works for that situation
in
that community. So, you know, We like and we work towards helping communities and site teams put things back into reuse, whatever the type of reuse, and don't put a value on that. We have several sites that are just wildlife refuges, and that, you know, we think that that's a fine use for certain sites.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if we've answered the person's question or not, Jean.
No, I think you guys did a great job. I think they were getting to exactly the type of idea that Tom was bringing up. Is one reuse easier because there are fewer liabilities or they're more popular that you've seen? So I think you guys did a great job. Looks like we've gone through all the questions that have come in electronically, so I'm going to turn to Michelle Mahoney first to see if she has any closing comments to leave with our audience before we start to close out today's webinar.
Well, I would like to thank our other presenters, Fran. It's always good to hear what's going on around the country and different sites and lots of opportunities. Just as they just summarized, there isn't a right or wrong way to do this. It's what the community desires and trying to make it fit if possible. And I would encourage everyone to visit the resources that were presented to you today and to get in touch with any of us if you have any questions and would like more information, or if you have a site that you'd like to talk about. We're here to help you, so I would encourage you to do that, and we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, Fran, any closing thoughts from you?
Definitely echoing what Michelle said, and also, Jean, I don't know if you had a chance to see, I sent you a direct link to the regional coordinators page, if you wouldn't mind sharing it, because it's, the website has so much information on it, it's a little hard to dig through and find that. If you need me to resend it, let me know.
I'll get that posted before we close out today.
Thanks, because that way people will see what states each of us deal with and how to get in touch with us. And, you know, if you can't tell, this, we find this information very exciting, and we love working on it. So we're here to help. Please use us. Thanks.
Excellent. Tom, any final statements from you?
No, I think we, you know, covered mostly everything we wanted to talk about. If anybody has any specifics, just give us a call and we can speak more specifically to their issues.
Okay, well, with that, let me go ahead and walk everybody through just a few final closing reminders. I want to thank the nearly 24 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. As noted earlier, we have made all of the presentations and videos available to download. You can follow the related links or resources link from the related URL pod and pull that up. For those of you that are joining us, if you can take a short moment and fill out the online feedback form, that would be greatly appreciated. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can hop on the line and fill out the form individually. That link will be active to the online feedback form from this point forward. So if you don't have time to fill it out now, you can certainly come back and fill that out later on. If you're, again, watching the recorded version of the webinar, you too can still follow the links under related URLs to the online feedback form and share your thoughts after this live delivery. For those of you looking for training certificates, we don't issue those necessarily for most of our Clouin webinars, but if you fill out that online feedback form, there is a box that you can check, and as long as your email address is entered correctly and that box is checked, we'll send you an automated confirmation email, which will at least verify that you shared feedback after the live session. If you save that email along with a copy of the presentation materials or a printout of the registration homepage, that's usually enough to document your participation and get credit with most institutions. If you need any help documenting or verifying your attendance in our webinars, you're certainly welcome to contact me directly at ballant.jean@epa.gov. Again, today's session was recorded, and we will share an automated playback link with all of the registered attendants in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. So again, thank you all so very much for joining us. Thank you to our three lovely presenters who did a phenomenal job delivering their talks today, and I hope that you all found this to be a valuable use of your time today. We are now going to formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you, and have a great day.